I'm David Wildman, and I work with the United Methodist Seminar Program, which is right across the street from the United Nations. And the United Nations, we talked about last night, has done an awful lot in relation to issues in the Middle East. And one of those issues that's really a crucial one, and a long-standing one of great pain and suffering, is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It has many names: the question of Palestine, the Arab-Israeli conflict. There's a number of different factors there. And so today we're going to focus specifically on the struggles and questions between Israelis and Palestinians. And so we're going to start with a video which is called, it's called Jordan's Stormy Banks. And it was first made by the Presbyterian and United Methodist churches as a slideshow back in 82, 83, around the time of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And gives a history of, from Abraham, goes back, all the way up to the present. Well, they just in 1990, the fall of 1990, updated it in the midst of the Persian Gulf crisis. And so then the last segment of it is redone a little bit, and it brings it all the way up to 1990. For 25 minutes, obviously, it skips a lot, but it's one of the best resources I found for really getting out a lot of information, whether you know some, none, or a lot about the Middle East. It's a good thing for a discussion starter. So I thought the format we take is to look at the video and then use that as the basis for a discussion. Not that we would just discuss what's in the video, but it provides a lot of information at that point. Then we can have some common knowledge to work with. As I said, it's about 25 minutes long. So you're going to have to let me know how the volume is, since I haven't used this machine before.
Yeah.
The Middle East, where Africa, Asia, and Europe meet. A cradle of civilization and a birthplace of empires from the beginning of human history. A region of desert sand and seacoast villages, of quiet fields and lively cities. For thousands of years, the Middle East was the most developed, the most cosmopolitan part of the world. It was a crossroads for the exchange of goods and ideas from distant places. The cities were proud centers of architecture and learning, of commerce and art, of power and religion. Babylon, Nineveh, Damascus, and Thebes.
Most of the religions had goddesses and gods for seed time and harvest, birth and death, war and peace, the crisis events of life. In the midst of these polytheisms, about 4,000 years ago, a man named Abraham came to the astounding faith that everything comes from one source alone. From that one creator come the cosmos and the human creature, judgment and forgiveness, life and death. All other divinities are human inventions, idols, hollow. Today there are three faith groups which have come from that revelation to Abraham. Judaism, with 18 million Jews worldwide. Christianity, with 1,670,000,000 Christians. And Islam, with 880 million Muslims. Together they include more than half the world's people. Though these monotheisms have much in common, their different histories and perspectives have led them to struggle with each other in the Middle East, especially in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, the city of David, has been the center of Judaism's religious affections for nearly 3,000 years. After the Hebrew armies led by King David captured Jerusalem, David's son Solomon built his temple there. Today, near the site of Solomon's temple is the Western Wall, known to some as the Wailing Wall, a tangible focus of Judaism in Jerusalem. Jesus was a Jew. He walked the streets of Jerusalem and taught his disciples there. It was in Jerusalem that he was crucified and buried, and it was there that his followers came to the earth-shaking conviction that God had raised Jesus from the dead in this very city. So, for nearly 2,000 years, the The memories and loyalties of Christians have also been focused on Jerusalem. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built on the traditional site of Jesus' burial and resurrection, stands only 1,000 yards from the Western Wall.
About 600 years after the birth of Jesus, Muhammad was born in the land now called Saudi Arabia. Although his own people believed there were many gods and demons, Muhammad had listened thoughtfully to the Jews and Christians he met. He became critical of the religious chaos and fear around him, and he often withdrew into the mountains to pray and meditate. There he had a vision of the angel Gabriel calling to him and revealing a message from God. When he told his wife Khadijah all that had happened, she believed him and encouraged him. Those revealed words, together with the subsequent revelations to Muhammad, became the Quran, the holy scripture of Islam. Muslims believe that in a vision, Muhammad saw himself on horseback in Jerusalem, on the mount where Solomon's temple, and later Herod's temple, had been. So, Jerusalem became a holy city for Muslims, as well as for Christians and Jews. A great shrine of Islam, called by many the Dome of the Rock, is built on the site of the temple. Thus, a continuing source of tension in the Middle East today is that these three world-encompassing faiths have historic ties to Jerusalem, with central shrines virtually side by side in the heart of the city. This shared love for Jerusalem might have made it a beacon of peace throughout the years. Instead, these sibling faiths have often contended for supremacy over it and over each other.
The history of the Jews is long and complex. For 1,000 years after King David, their capital was Jerusalem, and they lived in the land which over time has been called by many names: Canaan, Palestine, the Holy Land, Israel. In 70 AD, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed by the Roman armies. Gradually, Roman persecution scattered most of the Jews throughout the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. During the Crusades in the Middle Ages, Jews were expelled from England, France, Spain, and Portugal. In the following centuries, the Jews, a minority in Europe, suffered ongoing indignities and persecution at the hands of the Christian majority. Frequently, Jews were made the scapegoats and persecuted whenever nations lost at war or had economic troubles. In the 19th century, Jews began to be admitted to the universities and to have citizenship and political rights. But continuing anti-Semitism made it difficult for Jews to be fully accepted in many places.
In 1896, Theodor Herzl, a Jewish writer in Austria, founded the movement called Zionism. He was convinced that the Jews needed a homeland of their own, a refuge against persecution and discrimination. His supporters wanted this homeland to be in Palestine, and they wanted its name to be Israel. But almost 2,000 years had gone by since the Jews were scattered from ancient Israel, and the land that the Zionists dreamed of had been owned for centuries by other people. Some of the people in Palestine were Arab Christians, members of congregations that had been founded by the apostles. But most of the people who lived there were Arab Muslims. These Arab Muslims and Arab Christians, together with their children and grandchildren, are the people we today call Palestinians.
Politically, much of the Middle East had been ruled since the 16th century by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire. But during the 19th century, England and France gained control in many areas, and at the same time, the Arabs began to dream of freedom and self-government. World War I set the stage for political upheaval in the Middle East. In that war, Turkey joined forces with Germany against England, France, and Russia. England, attempting to bolster its war effort, made three contradictory promises. To the Jews, England promised in the 1917 Balfour Declaration to support the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. To the Arabs, England promised that after the war they could establish their own independent nations. To the French, England promised a share in ruling over the Middle East. When Germany and its supporters lost the war in 1918, France took control over what is now Lebanon and Syria, and England took control over Palestine, including Jordan. The League of Nations rubber-stamped their actions. England's promises of both a Jewish home and Arab independence were not fulfilled, but the hopes and expectations of those peoples remained alive and powerful.
In the 1940s, during World War II, Lebanon and Syria were released from French rule and became independent states. Meanwhile, England found that governing Palestine and Jordan was burdensome and costly, and in 1946, Jordan became an independent state. But the question of Palestine posed some special problems. In 1880, there had been 500,000 Arabs living in Palestine and 40,000 Jews. But as persecution of the Jews in Europe escalated into a holocaust of extermination, the Zionist dream of a safe homeland in Palestine had grown rapidly. The British had promised the Palestinian Arabs to limit the influx of Jews, but despite British efforts to block the shiploads of refugees from Europe, the Jewish population of Palestine steadily increased through immigration. By the end of World War II, Palestine contained 500,000 Jews, and the Arab population had grown to more than 1 million.
In some parts of Palestine, the increase of Jewish settlers had taken place peacefully, with Jews and Arabs living side by side in the cities and farmlands. In other places, there were violent confrontations. The Jews and Arabs were united in wanting the British to leave, but they could not agree on a plan for self-government. Finally, in 1947, the British announced that they would withdraw on May 14, 1948, and they turned over the problem of governance to the newly formed United Nations. A United Nations Special Commission proposed to divide Palestine into three parts: a Jewish state, an Arab state, and Jerusalem in a neutral zone administered by an international body. The Jews announced their intention to establish the State of Israel when the British withdrew. Both sides prepared for war. The weeks before the British withdrawal were very confusing. It is reported that sound trucks from both sides roamed the streets of Arab neighborhoods, warning civilians to pack a suitcase and leave for a week until the matter was settled. But the mayor of at least one Jewish city urged his Arab neighbors to stay. Many Palestinian families fled across the borders into the surrounding nations: Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt.
On May 14, 1948, the British departed, the Jews proclaimed the State of Israel, and President Truman immediately recognized Israel. Five Arab armies of adjoining states immediately rolled into the territory that had suddenly become Israel, and fighting began. The Israelis fought with determination, and by the time an armistice was signed 8 months later, Israel held 50% more of Palestine than originally recommended by the United Nations. The hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs who had fled the year before discovered that Israel would not let them return. Their land and their homes had been seized. They were people without a country, for Palestine no longer existed except in their hearts. Many Palestinians took refuge in temporary camps set up by the UN in the surrounding Arab countries. But the question of where they were to settle permanently was not resolved.
After more than 40 years, hundreds of thousands of people remain in those temporary camps. They are reluctant to settle away from their homeland. Many of the camps are in the open countryside. Others are shantytowns in cities and villages. The gravel streets are crowded with children and old people. Three generations of a family often must live in one room. In these camps, the Palestinians have built their own schools, hospitals, and orphanages. They struggle to provide for their own well-being. The UN and some Western churches have furnished medical, educational, and welfare services. In the beginning, the host countries tried to assist the Palestinians, but with the passing decades, many conflicts have arisen.
For 20 years, the Palestinians appealed to the United Nations and to the United States to help them get back home. But when they realized that help would be slow in coming, they established the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1964, a coordinating council of various Palestinian groups. The uneasy truces between Israel and the Arab states had been broken by several wars and many border skirmishes. Some Palestinians have launched terrorist attacks. Israel has shelled the Palestinian camps. In the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel expanded its control into Egypt to include the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip, into Jordan to include the West Bank territory, and into Syria to include the Golan Heights. During these years, the United States has supported Israel, supplying billions of dollars of military and economic aid annually, and regularly vetoing UN Security Council resolutions which would restrain or rebuke Israel's actions.
As the world attempts to understand the tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, each side can make a case for its perspectives. Each has a sense of entitlement. Israelis say Jews have had a special bond to this land for thousands of years. For decades now, we have poured our lives and our money into this land and made it prosper. We have welcomed Jewish refugees from persecution, though many have arrived ill and penniless. Many countries around us refuse to recognize Israel, and they threaten us. We have a right to live in our homeland in peace and security. The Palestinians say, it was not we who persecuted the Jews and launched the Holocaust. Why should they get our land in reparation? We have been forced off the fields owned and worked for 1,000 years by our ancestors. We are now a people without a country. We cannot even find places to bury our dead. But we can see our villages from across the border, and we want to go home. Yasser Arafat, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, has said of Golda Meir, former prime minister of Israel, how could this Jewish lady, born in Russia and raised in the United States, who came to Palestine as an adult American citizen, tell me she belonged in Jerusalem and I did not? I was born in Jerusalem. So, although the PLO has recognized the State of Israel, Palestinians do not want to agree that Israel is the legitimate authority over all the land that was Palestine. And Israelis do not want to agree that the PLO is the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people.
Many factors affect the situation in which the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis is taking place. 1. The boundaries between many Middle Eastern countries were originally drawn by European powers for European purposes. Where they do not make geographic or social sense, they continue to cause trouble. 2. The oil in the Middle East is used throughout the world. Every nation is affected in some way by this energy supply. 3. World tensions frequently get focused on the Middle East. For decades, the interests of the United States have appeared to conflict with the interests of the Soviet Union. More recently, the Iran-Iraq War and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait have focused global attention on the region. 4. The media portray the people of the Middle East as either Muslim or Jew. But millions of Middle Easterners are Christian, and they too have a stake in the outcome of the current tensions. 5. Within each faith group, there is great diversity. Pope John Paul and Billy Graham would disagree on many things. Muslims and Jews must deal with diversity in their communities also. 6. The Bible stories learned by many American Christians affect our understanding of the present. As children in Sunday school, we rejoiced when little Hebrew David triumphed over big Philistine Goliath. We were taught that it was God's victory. Today, as adults, some may still believe that God always favors Israel. 7. The book of Revelation gives a dazzling vision of Christ's return to earth and the gathering of the Jews within the borders of ancient Israel. That vision makes some Christians eager for the state of Israel to take over all of Palestine, to hasten the day of Christ's coming.
Other Christians reject this apocalyptic interpretation. They concentrate their efforts on seeking the justice and peace, the shalom, promised in the Bible. In 1980, the National Council of Churches sent a study team to the Middle East to help search for the pathways to peace. The NCC is a coalition of 32 Christian churches in the United States. Because of its long-standing commitment to justice and peace, it has frequently been attacked by groups who felt threatened by its statements. Leaders of the Middle East Council of Churches welcomed the study team and helped them to meet with people from all sides. This council is a coalition of Christian churches throughout the entire region. The American visitors saw the impact of violence, the violence of terrorists and the violence of armies of occupation. When they returned with their recommendations, the ending of violence was a central concern. In November 1980, the National Council of Churches adopted unanimously a policy statement based on the findings of the committee. This statement still relevant after a decade, calls for an end to all acts of violence, for Arabs to recognize the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state with secure borders, for Israel to recognize the right of Palestinians to national self-determination, to select their own representatives, and to establish a sovereign state apart from Jordan if they choose, for solutions to the refugee problem, and for negotiations on the future of Jerusalem. These recommendations were consistent with the 1967 Resolution No. 242 of the United Nations Security Council, which emphasized the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war.
In 1978, the Camp David agreements between Israel and Egypt raised world hopes for peace in the Middle East. Israel withdrew from the Sinai, but in 1981, it destroyed an Iraqi nuclear facility using planes and bombs built in the U.S. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon to destroy Palestinian armed forces there. Beirut suffered heavy attacks from land, sea, and air for 2 months. After a ceasefire in August, the Palestinian forces left Beirut by sea to spare further destruction to the city, having secured guarantees of safety for the Palestinian civilians who would be left behind. On September 15th, Israeli forces took control of West Beirut. The following day, the UN Security Council adopted unanimously Resolution 520, condemning the Israeli incursions into Beirut in violation of the ceasefire agreements. On the next day, 1,000 Palestinian men, women, and children in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps under the control of Israeli forces were massacred by Lebanese armed forces, mostly Christian. Finally, the Israeli forces withdrew to South Lebanon, where they have continued to occupy a zone that extends about 10 miles into Lebanon. UN peacekeeping forces are there also, but they have not been able to prevent violence among the many factions that clash. The Palestinian forces set up their headquarters in Tunisia, but in 1986, Israeli planes bombed their center there, killing 100 people, mostly civilians. Throughout the 1980s, Israel frequently attacked the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon with bombs from the air and shells from ships at sea. By the mid-1980s, the situation was deadlocked. The PLO refused to recognize Israel's right to exist. Israel refused to hold any direct talks with the PLO. King Hussein of Jordan repeatedly called for an international peace conference convened by the UN and including all interested parties. Israel said no, a major reason being that the PLO would be a participant. In December 1987, 4 Palestinians in Gaza were killed in a collision with an Israeli army truck. Suddenly, a spontaneous uprising, an intifada, took place throughout Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinian youths, still refusing to use guns, began to throw stones at the occupying patrols. The soldiers responded with beatings and the breaking of bones, tear gas, and gunfire. Whenever the army thought it had located the home of a stone thrower's family, that house was demolished. By December 1990, some 1,000 Palestinians and 50 Israelis had been killed. Late in 1988, the PLO declared an independent Palestinian state and endorsed UN Resolution 242, implying PLO recognition of Israel. Yasser Arafat stated explicitly that the Palestine National Council recognizes two states, a Palestinian state and a Jewish state, Israel.
Peace in the Middle East does depend upon establishing a homeland for the Palestinian people. The territory most frequently suggested for a Palestinian state is the West Bank and Gaza. 800,000 Palestinians live in the West Bank under Israeli occupation. Since 1975, Israel has built more than 100 armed settlements there. More than 70,000 Jews, some of them coming from the United States, have moved into these settlements. Israelis now own or control more than half of the West Bank. They express a deep sense of entitlement to the land. Despite some uneasiness about Israel's actions, the United States continues to send massive aid to Israel, economic and military. Newspapers and television continue to refer to Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East. United States government aid to Israel amounts to more than $3 billion annually, about $4,000 per year for each Israeli family of four. Israel seeks additional U.S. funds to assist in the relocation of Russian Jews. These immigrants are displacing Palestinians from their jobs in Israel. Private contributions by Americans to Israel are large. Gifts to Israel through some American organizations qualify for U.S. tax exemption. The planes and many of the bombs used by the military have been made in the United States. It is easy to see why the Arab nations and the Palestinians are convinced that Israel represents the U.S. in the Middle East.
In the summer of 1990, the winding down of the Cold War in Europe heightened world hopes for peace. But in August, Iraq invaded wealthy Kuwait, after having been told a week earlier by U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie that the United States had no opinion on the Arab-Arab conflicts like your border dispute with Kuwait. Within days, the U.S. began a military buildup in Saudi Arabia, and it led the way in convincing the U.N. Security Council to condemn Iraq's action. Ironically, the U.N. resolutions against Iraq expressed the same principle used in Resolution 242, so long ignored. Territory may not be gained by military action. The principle the U.S. intends to enforce in the Gulf is the principle it has been willing to overlook in the Arab-Israeli conflict. As 1990 came to an end, the threat of war was very real. President Bush declared that there could be no negotiation with Iraq's Saddam Hussein. The U.S. Congress was trying to decide whether it should take any action, and if so, what? But the National Council of Churches issued a forthright statement to its members and to the nation in November. It called upon the U.S. to withdraw its troops from the Gulf region, except those which might be required and explicitly recommended by the Security Council. It recommended that the U.S. pursue every means for a negotiated political solution to the crisis. It repeated its call for an international peace conference under UN auspices as a means of implementing Security Council resolutions on Israel and Palestine, Lebanon and Cyprus, recognizing that the present crisis cannot be isolated from the unresolved issues of the region as a whole. The National Council's resolution reminds the world of an ancient truth: an enduring peace can be built only on the foundation of justice. Through the various Middle Eastern crises, the world is discovering the importance of the United Nations. Perhaps the world will now also discover the role that the International Court of Justice can play in finding a fair pathway to peace. Jews, Christians, and Muslims must pray and take counsel together to insist that the time has come for the world to beat its swords into plowshares and to study war no more. It is a commandment from the God who spoke to Abraham so long ago.
I had a question before, and I still have it, about, you know, how it happened that when Israel formed initially in the 40s and Eisenhower and the administration aligned themselves with Israel, and it's been that way ever since. How and why did that happen?
That's an interesting process. It was actually Truman,
Truman.
In 1948. And he recognized Israel about 11 minutes after they declared themselves a state. When they said immediately, they meant immediately. And that left an impression on the Arab world. One place where you can get some information about that that's come up recently in the news is Clark Clifford, who was a young advisor to Truman during his administration, and has served in many administrations, just came out with a biography, autobiography, that talks about that time period, and that Truman initially was not particularly concerned about recognizing Israel or dealing with that, and Marshall, of the Marshall Plan, who was Secretary of State, and probably one of the most powerful men in the administration, was clearly opposed to recognizing Israel. But Clifford was one of the ones who was very in favor of recognizing Israel. So he has some sort of inside information as to the debates going on. Obviously, he's telling it from his perspective, so it's You know, another question as to why was that? There's a lot of, over the years, in terms of why the U.S. has continued that support, and the support has gone in cycles. Prior to the 60s, there was not a lot of financial support in the way that from basically 67 on, there's been billions of dollars each year. Israel's the largest recipient of foreign aid of any country by the United States. And at certain points, in when wars have broken out, like the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the United States airlifted massive military support over there. And this year, they're considering additional money for the damages that Israel received from Scud attacks, as well as money to help with the settlement of Soviet Jews. Technically, it shouldn't be in this occupied territories, but we're sort of lax on that. So it's sort of a complicated alliance there and a history.
Isn't one of the answers, though, that there aren't many Muslims or many Palestinians in the U.S. Congress?
That's, I mean, that's
pretty
basic
difference, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a significant Jewish population in the United States, and fairly vocal. There's also a lot of historic links, as the film talked about, in terms of certain Christian groups seeing Israel as strategic to the end times and their return to the second coming, and therefore a real strong need to support Israel, because in terms of the battle with the Antichrist, Israel will be on our side. It will be the United States and Israel against the world, the forces of the Antichrist.
But that's not what Truman was thinking 11 minutes
no,
after.
No, and he wasn't thinking of any of that. And the question you have to raise is, you know, from just a straight economic standpoint, it would seem that going with the Arab countries that have oil is a much wiser thing to do, and sort of, you know, anti-Semitism's been around for a long time. Why not? Why should we care about Israel now? You know, we have our own history. Europe has its history of anti-Semitism. So I think some of it can be explained in terms of that Israel has served, in some sense, as a surrogate army for us, doing our interests within the region. And there's been a sort of tit for tat. They've gotten an awful lot from us, but we've also gotten certain things from them in terms of the use of the Israeli intelligence and other things. Other?
Wasn't there also, right after the Second World War, there was a lot of guilt on behalf of the Western countries related to the Holocaust that had gone on? And I know from Canadian and the stories that come out now that were opportunities for the governments to allow immigrants of Jewish refugees, even when we knew what was going on in the Holocaust, when we said no, mm-hmm. and wouldn't let them in our country. And so that made us want to support in some way the homeland for the yeah. Jewish people. And probably also to a certain extent not wanting a rash of immigration of Jewish people into our country right after the
Well, clearly, one of the major options for Jews in Europe after World War II was to come to the United States. New York City is the largest Jewish city in the world today. There's a very, you know, already many Jewish immigrants came in the 1880s on. And there's no reason why, you know, we opened our borders many times to various groups, that they couldn't come here and find a community that they could easily integrate into and assimilate. But in fact, the policies of the United States government and the policies of the Zionists that were working on the establishment of the State of Israel were to discourage that, because if it was given this option of going to a place rife with conflict where folks are fighting, or going to the United States, the land of plenty and opportunity for everyone, where would someone choose to go? Many had family members over here and didn't have family members in Palestine. And so there was some concerted efforts by a number of forces, you know, Ben-Gurion and some of the other early Zionists who established the State of Israel were very clear they did not want the U.S. to open its borders to Jews.
because that would encourage more and more to come to the Holy Land. Other questions or comments?
You made an interesting comment a couple days ago on your presentations when you talked about the military sales and the power of that within the military industrial complex within the United States, and how much of the sales is increased, obviously, when you have kind of an unrest and where you have people buying because they're uncertain. How much do you feel that continues to play in the lack of resolution that was real clear?
Well, I certainly think that the U.S. is concerned that the balance of power in the region be relatively unstable. And they don't want anyone in the Arab world or the Middle East getting too powerful. And for a long time, for many years, for decades, Israel and Iran under the Shah from 1953 to 1979 were two pillars, or as Henry Kissinger said, two eyes for the United States on the Middle East. But they were at either end, in some sense, of where all the oil was, and could keep close tabs, and they were both non-Arab countries. Well, with the fall of the Shah, you now have a suddenly different dynamic. Israel's our only ally in the region, although Turkey is, to some degree, an ally. I think there was the sense that they could. We didn't particularly care about the tensions between the Arabs and Israelis. In fact, we tried to block, as I pointed out there, any kind of sanctions. It's gone beyond a reprimand, sort of slap on the wrist. The United States has vetoed, or just made it known that we would veto, so that they never, other folks on the Security Council never introduced a resolution to go beyond just sort of condemning something, but not putting any sanctions behind it. In terms of the arms trade piece, I don't know if I didn't bring it with me, I'm sorry, but the New York Times, in the first week of June, remember how during the Gulf War, one of the things was no linkage? We can't link a peaceful resolution of the Gulf crisis with a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli crisis. That's really the terms. There should be no linkage between peaceful settlement and peaceful settlement, in other words, a peace conference. The threat of having a peace conference is a reason to go to war. Was a little, and then what did we do after the war ended? The first thing we did was Baker's over there meeting with Syria and Jordan and Israel to talk about what? Peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli crisis. So we did link it. I mean, everybody linked it. It was just how we linked it and when we thought it was convenient to say it was or not. Well, Baker was over there, I don't know how many times, five or six times in the space of a couple months, so he kept sort of bouncing back and forth. And after his trips, Cheney went around to the same countries and worked on arms sales and arms supplies to one country after another. The first week of June, there was an article in the New York Times about Middle East arms sales, that they had agreed to sell attack helicopters to the United Arab Emirates for defensive purposes. And that itself is sort of ironic. You need attack helicopters to defend yourself. But in that article it said, this is less than a week after we gave used F-15 fighters to Israel, 10 or 15 of them. And the picture right next to this article is of F-15 fighters bombing Palestinian camps in Lebanon. And it was the largest scale bombings, three straight days of bombings, since 1982 war. So, the juxtaposition there was quite ironic of Israel is using US planes to bomb the most expensive bombings in 8 years, 9 years. And the same week,
the United States is announcing we're going to give them more of those planes. So, you know, in terms of the arms supply, there's definitely a relationship there.
So it's to our advantage, or at least to the advantage of the military, the people who sell and deal in these, to have it be, to not have there be peace over there.
Well, if there is peace, there's not, you know, there's not a real market in it. Europe, for instance, in Western Europe, for us to sell weapons. The countries are beginning to see that borders are obsolete. And they're, you know, they're moving towards a common market, and a variety of changes in 1992. That's not a real fruitful place to sell weapons. But if you've got a lot of regional turmoil, that's an, you know, and folks with a lot of money, in terms of the wealthy Arab states, then you've got real opportunities.
So, do you think then the U.S. really doesn't want to try and push any kind of a peace conference there?
Yeah, my own personal impression is that Baker's efforts are not very genuine. That there needed to be some efforts to resolve that crisis. But consistently, the United States has not been very concerned about supporting Palestinians. And you need always to distinguish, I think, between the rhetoric that we have and the practice. And Baker's rhetoric on the Middle East has been about as anti-Israeli as any public, you know, administrative official in the U.S. history, you know, in the history of Israel. He's been far more critical than anybody in the Reagan administration or Carter or the others of Israel. And at one point last spring of 90, a year ago, before the Gulf crisis, he was so exasperated with the Israelis and their continually building settlements in the West Bank, he said, when you guys are ready to be serious about negotiating, you know our phone number, give me a call. That's a sort of harsh statement to say to a long-standing ally. But if you look at the practice, the settlements continue to be built, and we continue to provide loan guarantees and various other forms of aid. And in some sense, that's consistent with our policy around the world. You know, human rights violations occur in a country like El Salvador. And we say, this is terrible, this is an atrocity, and we're going to cut off all aid if you do this again. Well, the next year, further human rights violations, and we say, this is terrible, this is an atrocity, and we won't let it happen again. And we'll give you more aid. So that there's this mixed message between the practice of what actually happens and where our money goes, and what we publicly proclaim.
But is the win for the U.S. just to keep things stirred up so you can sell arms to both sides? Do you think that's the win? Like in El Salvador, I mean, I the U.S. I think is afraid a regime is going to come down there that they can't control. But I don't know what's the win in the Middle East for. I mean, it seems like the U.S. has suffered some too from a lot of Palestinian irritation, you know, with individual acts of terrorism. And
yeah, I think there are certainly, you know, questions as to why continue that policy. I mean, wouldn't we benefit from a peaceful resolution of that conflict? And that's really hard to sort out. I mean, I don't want to pretend to, you know, understand the motivations behind it all. But in some ways, our support of Israel has not at all damaged our relationships with wealthy oil-producing states in the Arab world. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the other small Gulf states relate to us quite well.
Mm-hmm.
The antagonism has been with larger and poorer or more moderate income Arab countries. And we have less at stake with them. I mean, what they think of us is not, you know, Syria, Assad was the number one terrorist prior to Hussein taking that slot. And now he conveniently becomes an ally.
It seems as the U.S. plays the position of world police, that if there was peace in the region, our control would be lessened and we wouldn't be able to be playing and calling shots in that region that's so important to us.
In my mind, the major danger the United States is worried about is a powerful Arab country mobilizing not just itself, but the region in some form of alliance that would be anti-Western, and say, we've got oil, and we're only selling it to you, not on an economic basis, but on certain political conditions. And then the United States is in trouble, not because we need the oil, but because we've brokered how it gets distributed, and our four out of the six largest oil corporations are U.S.-based, so there's a lot of financial linkage to how the flow of oil goes. So if something happens like in Iran, where we can't control what Iran does, and we can't necessarily buy them out, in effect, you know, offer them a good price or something like that, because they have their own independent political thinking of what should happen in the region. If that happens in the Arab world, that the countries get together not just to make a buck, which has basically been what Saudi Arabia and others have done, but to assert some sort of Arab political presence, then that's the thing we fear most. And what happens is that Israel is serving as our surrogate in the region to make sure that the Arab world doesn't, if it's organized, it's organized against Israel as opposed to for, you know, against the West or something else.
So you think that the U.S. wants neither peace nor war? They kind of want both, the best of both or something, neither peace nor conflict. So the contrast between Baker's rhetoric and action is exemplary of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly if you look at the Iran-Iraq war, we basically wanted them to kill each other and keep killing each other, because we provided missiles to both sides, weapons to both sides. You know, what's the message? You find out that, I mean, the Iraqis see us as a major ally, and then discover we're secretly, through Israel, sending weapons to Iran. And the whole Iran-Contra process in terms of weapons for hostages was through Israel. Israel is the one that delivered all the missiles and other things that then led to the release of some hostages. So.
I just had a question. There's occasionally there are references to the Seven Sisters, or which I guess are the six or seven biggest oil companies. What do you know the names of those companies?
Yeah. Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, Texaco, British Petroleum, though the first four are the U.S. owned firms, and Shell, which is Dutch, Royal Dutch Shell.
There used to be seven?
It was merged into Chevron, and I can't remember who was it. Someone else was down.
Gulf,
that's right. Huh. But Gulf's not. Now, what's interesting is, in terms of the oil connection, Texaco has 11,000 some stations, gas stations around. Half of them are jointly owned by the government of Kuwait. And if you look at the folks that are in Bush's cabinet that come out, Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and a number of other folks that come out of the oil industry, and Bechtel, which is a large construction firm that does construction primarily with oil-related stuff. And Bush himself. And the links between them and the Kuwaiti government is fascinating stuff. I mean, there's a lot of interconnection there. Now, if you look at a 1992 presidential campaign, and where is the major source of funding in terms of political action committees and other things, you're going to look to large corporations, because they're the largest givers. And between the military corporations and oil corporations, you have a lot of friends you can call in the cards in terms of campaign contributions. If you want to get into sort of conspiracy approaches, there's certainly plenty of grounds there to
to wonder what's going on behind the scenes. So, you know. Well, we certainly haven't answered any questions here, but thank you.